Good morning. This is Brian Trump with a week in review for Saturday, September 3rd. It could be quite a week in the markets coming up worldwide as Congress is back. President Obama totally misuses the traditional form of a nationally televised address to a joint session of the House and Senate to spell out a jobs program that now, over 2.5 years into his term, is the one that will save us. And Europe has all kinds of important events as it struggles to maintain the union amidst its sovereign debt crisis. As for Obama's speech, which will now air right before opening night for the NFL and be filled with his now standard boilerplate garbage, we're told the speech will contain three main components: an increase in infrastructure spending, for which it shouldn't be difficult to identify new projects, just follow the path of Hurricane Irene, an aggressive plan to deal with housing foreclosures, and more clean energy boondoggles, see the failure of Solyndra. No doubt some of what will be proposed is needed. I mean, it's kind of important if a bridge between two communities that have been around for centuries suddenly goes out or is about to. And there will be no sustainable economic recovery without the same in housing. But we can't have another series of failures as we've witnessed since the Obama administration came into office, and on other fronts back to the George W. Bush era. Nobel Prize-winning economist Gary Becker, who was long one of my favorites when he penned a regular column for the Old Business Week, could not have been more spot on than he was in a Wall Street Journal op-ed this week. Quote, "This recession might well have been a deep one, even with good government policies, but government failure added greatly to its length and severity, including its continuation to the present. In the U.S., these government actions included almost $1 trillion in federal spending that was supposed to stimulate the economy. Leading government economists, backed up by essentially no evidence, argued that this spending would stimulate the economy by enough to reduce unemployment rates to under 8%. Such predictions have been so far off the mark as to be embarrassing. Although definitive studies are not yet available about the stimulus package's overall effects on the American economy, most everyone agrees that it was badly designed and executed. What the stimulus did produce is a sizable expansion of the federal deficit and debt. The expansion of government resulting from these stimulus and other government programs contributed to rising deficits and growing public debt just when the U.S. faced the prospect of big increases in future debt due to built-in commitments to raise government spending on entitlements. Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare already account for about 40% of total federal government spending, and this share will grow rapidly during the next couple of decades unless major reforms are adopted." Gary Becker continues, "A reasonably well-functioning government would try to sharply curtail the expected growth in entitlements, but such reform is not part of the budget deal between Congress and President Obama that led to a higher debt ceiling. Nor, given the looming 2012 elections, is such reform likely to be addressed seriously by the congressional panel set up to produce further reductions in federal spending. It is a commentary on the extent of government failure that despite the improvements during the past few decades in the mental and physical health of older men and women, no political agreement seems possible on delaying access to Medicare beyond age 65. No means testing, as in Representative Paul Ryan's budget roadmap, will be introduced to determine eligibility for full Medicare benefits, and most Social Security benefits will continue to start for individuals at age 65 or younger." Gary Becker continues, "In a nutshell, there is little political will to reduce spending on entitlements by limiting them mainly to persons in need. State and local governments also greatly increased their spending as tax revenues rolled in during the good economic times that preceded the collapse in 2008. The spending included extensive commitments to deferred benefits that could not be easily reduced after the recession hit, especially pensions and health care benefits to retired government workers. Unless states like California and Illinois and cities like Chicago take drastic steps to reduce their deferred spending, their problems will multiply as their spending grows over time. A few newly elected governors, such as Scott Walker in Wisconsin, have pushed through reforms to curtail the power of unionized state employees, but most other governors have been afraid to take on the unions and their political supporters. The lesson is that it is crucial to consider whether government regulations and laws are likely to improve rather than worsen the performance of private markets. In an article, Competition and Democracy, published more than 50 years ago, I said monopoly and other imperfections are at least as important and perhaps substantially more so in the political sector as in the marketplace. Does the existence of market imperfections justify government intervention? The answer would be no, if the imperfections in government behavior were greater than those in the market. The widespread demand after the financial crisis for radical modifications to capitalism typically paid little attention to whether in fact proposed government substitutes would do better rather than worse than markets. Government regulations and laws are obviously essential to any well-functioning economy. Still, when the performance of markets is compared systematically to government alternatives, markets usually come out looking pretty darn good. That was Gary Becker in an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. So we await the president and then the super committee of 12 House and Senate members that must begin deliberations by September 16 and come up with a deficit reduction plan of at least $1.2 trillion by November 23rd. And then you've got an increasingly contentious Federal Reserve, with some members upset. Chairman Ben Bernanke set a specific time period for keeping interest rates at zero, and with an important two-day meeting coming up September 2021. Can Bernanke offer another quantitative easing program, QE3? What are these mystery tools he is said to possess? Targeting the 10-year and taking it to 0.2? Continuing to screw savers who now need to live to be 6,875 in order to double their money? Just having fun with you rule of 72 junkies out there. Appearing on CNBC about 10 days ago, one of my other favorite economists, Stephen Roach, blasted Bernanke for QE2, saying it, quote, failed. Yeah, there was a pop in the stock market, but the jobless problem is more severe than anyone thought, he said. I didn't see if Mr. Roach commented after Friday's jobs report for August, but I imagine he had a look of disgust when the report was revealed. Unchanged, as in zero jobs created, and a big revision down on the previous 2 months as well. The unemployment rate also remained unchanged at 9.1%, though we all know the unofficial rate is far higher, 16. It is sickening what is happening in this country. No doubt, some of us made some very poor decisions with our finances, but the great middle class that has long been the bulwark is sliding into the abyss. Ditto the middle class in Europe. But aside from large reductions in pensions and social services as a result of needed austerity programs, Europe has an issue the United States has largely escaped: transparency, or lack thereof. For all the faults of the U.S. banking system, I at least have some confidence, call it a modicum, that our financial institutions are fairly transparent post Lehman et al. This is far from the case in Europe, as was pointed out this week when a shouting match broke out between the International Monetary Fund, the International Accounting Standards Board, IASB, and the European Central Bank. The first two saying that the European banks have not been properly writing down their Greek exposure, the IASB's chief complaint, as well as the exposure to the other pigs, Portugal, Ireland, Italy, and Spain, the IMF's issue. The European Central Bank defended the accounting, touting the recent stress test, which were a freaking joke. As I wrote a long time ago regarding the handling of the euro debt crisis, it really is about as pure an example of a Ponzi scheme as you'll ever find. Good money after bad, good money after bad, with each round. You need look no further than Greece. The EU, ECB, IMF are committed to some $286 billion in further funding through 2014 for the Greeks, yet now it is possible the debt-to-GDP ratio here will near 200% in 2012. The economy is sinking deeper and deeper into the Aegean, so let's throw more money at it. The thing is, as I've been pointing out ad nauseum, you hear these numbers bandied about, the $286 billion, the $440 billion for the European Financial Stability Facility, $500 billion for a second EFSF, and so on, but none of them have actually been formally approved. Oh, sure, officials got together and okayed a structure for saving the Euro 17 on July 21st, but it's not official until all 17 parliaments approve it. You've heard it is, but try actually finding the money for these various facilities. I'm telling you, folks, it ain't there yet, and Greece needs gobs of it for its funding purposes this month. Germany's parliament, for example, doesn't vote on the second Greek bailout and the EFSF until September 29. While on September 7th, the German High Court is to rule on a long-running legal challenge to the financial support already provided to other European states by the German government and the ECB. If either decision went against German participation, Katja bar the door, though this week Chancellor Merkel appeared to shore up support in Parliament. Merkel faces key elections in her home state on Sunday and in Berlin on September 18th, which will be critical to her keeping her coalition and thus participation in the Eurozone rescue intact. And I haven't even begun talking about Finland, Austria, and others now wanting collateral from Greece, whose last great asset was the late actress Melina Mercouri, who happened to be a communist, some say socialist, but I digress, before they'll participate in the bailout. Or the fact Italy's government is suddenly waffling on an austerity program demanded by the EU and ECB that it just approved. Among the only people speaking the truth these days on the continent is the IMF's new director, Christine Lagarde, who, as the Financial Times editorialized, quote, said publicly what most policymakers have avoided addressing since the crisis began. Using her new bully pulpit, Lagarde has conceded that the common problem facing the developed world is an excessive overhang of claims on debt that financed worthless investments. These claims will have to be liquidated, and the quicker the better. Ms. Lagarde deserves praise for spelling out the problem and issuing a call to action. But to reserve it also requires policymakers to decide where the losses should fall. She thinks they should land on taxpayers. This is wrong-headed. She focused on two big risks, the continuing frailty of European banks and the continuing house price falls in the U.S. and the growing number of homeowners trapped in negative equity. Both threaten the recovery, editorializes the Financial Times. Doubts about the health of European banks could, if untreated, lead to another credit squeeze. The recent round of stress tests has not dispelled fears that undercapitalized institutions have been banking on a recovery to allow them to retain sufficient earnings to repair balance sheets. Meanwhile, the U.S. mortgage mess crimps consumer spending by saddling distressed homeowners with excessive liabilities and preventing them from moving to where the jobs are. Well, I just wanted to give you the FT's opinion. The issue is taxpayers versus private investors, assuming the latter don't go to the rescue of the banks. The thing is, none of the above would be a concern, including debt levels in the United States, if the economy was growing. But instead of a normal post-recession recovery of 3-4% in the developed world or more, see the 1980s, Europe and the United States are perilously close to tipping over again, while Japan is back in recession. The Purchasing Managers Index in the Eurozone fell below the 50 dividing line between contraction and expansion, 49.0 in August, with only Germany, 50.9 among the important players above water. Italy slid to 47.0. Greece down to 43.3. Just to pick a few other Euro continent factoids, the GDP estimate for 2011 in the UK continues to tumble to 1.1% by one estimate as home prices are falling along with consumer confidence. Overall, Euro business confidence is at its lowest level since December 2008. Europe is struggling due to flagging Asian demand and on and on. Speaking of Asia, China's government is hell-bent on taming inflation as the central bank raised reserve requirements on the leading financial institutions a 12th time since the beginning of 2010 in an effort to slow the pace of lending. Premier Wen Jiabao said the slowdown in the economy is reasonable as the official government PMI for August came in at 50.9, though HSBC has it at 49.9. Elsewhere, unemployment ticked up in the aforementioned Japan. South Korea is slowing, Taiwan is, they all are in the region. India's second quarter GDP came in at a robust 7.7%, but this is still a lower figure than before. Australia's PMI for August was 43.3, though retail sales surprised to the upside there. Canada's GDP for Q2 fell, albeit at an annualized rate of 0.4%, when a gain was expected. And Brazil surprised everyone when it lowered interest rates after raising them five straight times amid concerns over the global slowdown and the impact on its economy. Even back in the U.S., where the markets took solace early in the week with better-than-expected manufacturing readings out of Chicago and the ISM, they were still down from the prior reporting month. Oh, there was some decent news out of the nation's retailers in August, at least from some of them, and auto sales for August were a little better than projected, but hardly worth opening a new dealership on. Turning to Wall Street, after a very solid start and seemingly better economic news, including a better-than-expected figure on consumer spending, stocks collapsed at week's end owing to the awful employment report and renewed concerns over Europe. The Dow Jones fell 0.4% to 11,240, while the S&P 500 lost 0.2%, and NASDAQ picked up a fraction, though technically unchanged. That's all I have for this week. I'll be back with you next Saturday. For further details, go to stocksandnews.com. Click on Week in Review. Have a good one. Take care.